We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From WILL, Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Kyle Mabry. Upon waking, you may recall a dream and find yourself wondering, what was that about? Why do we dream? And here are two more questions. Why do we require sleep? And what happens within our brains as we sleep? This morning, our guest is sleep researcher Rosalind Cartwright. She's the author of the new book, The 24-Hour Mind, The Role of Sleep and Dreaming in Our Emotional Lives. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. Join us with a phone call or by email. I look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Rosalind Cartwright is Professor Emeritus of Rush University Medical Center's Graduate College Neuroscience Division. Until 2008, she chaired the college's Department of Behavioral Sciences. Some 30 years ago, she founded the first Sleep Disorder Service and Research Center to be accredited in the state of Illinois. Her latest book, The 24-Hour Mind, The Role of Sleep and Dreaming in Our Emotional Lives, is published by the Oxford University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu. Dr. Cartwright, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How did you sleep?
I slept very well, thank you. And you?
I did too. Good.
Okay, so we're ready and raring to go here this morning.
Very good.
Okay. Well, how much attention do you pay to your dreams?
Well, you know, like everybody else, if I'm sleeping without an alarm clock, so that it doesn't rudely interrupt my sleep, and I sleep long enough, then I do remember the last dream of the night, usually, and not for long unless I work at it. And that's a problem that most of us have. That is, we get up and we're busy, and we don't file that memory of the last dream unless it is so disturbing or so vivid. You know, if the last dream tends to be the longest one and the most emotional one. And if it is really startling to you, you wake up saying, holy smokes, what was that? Then you're likely to remember it. And at that point, I say, lie still, let the REM situation continue, that is, no muscle movement, and rehearse what images you can remember and give it a title. Because if we put it into language, we're much more likely to remember it. So, you know, I say that was the dream of my mother's ghost in my closet, or that was the dream of my date with Robert Redford. Then I can remember it and write it down when I open my eyes.
Why is the last dream of the night the longest and the most emotional?
Well, because we have two types of sleep going on all night. And the deep sleep, the non-dreaming sleep, is preemptive. That's the sleep where a good deal of our physiological repair goes on. That's when growth hormone has its largest surge. So that deep sleep that comes first before dreaming is physiologically preemptive, if you like. And so the first half of the night is proportionately more heavily non-REM, and the last half is proportionately heavier REM sleep, although there is the cycling between the two types every hour and a half. So the first dreams of the night are pretty short, like little previews of coming attractions, and then they get longer as the night goes on.
It seems our brains do first things first, then.
That's right. Well, they take care of the body first, and then the mind says, hey, I need some time, and we get these nice, long, interesting dreams.
Often when we've got a big decision ahead of us, we think to ourselves or say to one another, let's sleep on it.
Uh-huh.
Of course, a good night's sleep restores us. Is one of the tasks, though, of the sleeping brain to work on questions we've been confronted with in our waking lives?
Absolutely. Excuse me, that's one of the messages of the 24-hour title of my book, and that is that we now are paying attention to putting together what we're doing in waking and what we're doing in sleeping, and understanding that there is this carryover, that we don't just turn off when we turn off the bedside lamp. We don't turn the mind off. It continues to work on anything that is emotionally important to you. And so there's a sorting process at the beginning of the night as to what is going to be saved from the day. And what you've given emotional attention to as important to you is likely to be carried through and worked on throughout the night.
The 24-hour mind, are sleep researchers in agreement on this, that the mind, the brain, is at work 24 hours a day?
Yes, and that's news, because psychology and neuroscience and the brain people had been really discounting sleep and feeling nothing much of interest is going on there because we're not conscious. So it's not really important, you know, that we're big problem solvers when we pay attention when we're awake. But now we know that sleep researchers have been plowing this field and coming up with very interesting information for a number of years, and it's time we put the two disciplines together and see us as a whole, with the mind working 24 hours in our behalf.
Would you talk a little bit about the work that you did involving dreams, people and their dreams? And these were people who were in the process of a divorce.
Oh, yes. Well, that was a very interesting longitudinal study. Went on for many years with federal funding because I had noted that people who are upset over a life event, sometimes with a death in the family, and they were grieving, or a divorce, a loss of a loved person for some reason, that some people became quite depressed, and that hung on beyond the usual adjustment period or grieving period, and that some of them got depressed and some didn't. And I wondered whether that was not a good place to look at what the night was doing to either help or to kind of get them into a repetitive rut about how to process this new information or new part of their self-concept. I'm now single again. I'm no longer married. Or, you know, I'm now an orphan because my parents have died. And you have to absorb that new information. Some people did it pretty well on their own. Some people became clinically depressed. So I use that as a model to look into whether the sleep and dreaming processes in those two kinds of reactions to divorce showed us something about the process being healthy or not healthy. And yes, indeed, I did learn a lot, And I'm very grateful for those people who volunteered to come and sleep over and over and over in the lab while I watched that process happening. And those that got over it, their dreams were very different from those who got stuck in depression. And that taught me about the healthy process that dreaming performs and that gets stuck in those who remain depressed and need some psychotherapy or medication or both to break up that depression. What I learned is that the healthy process of managing some new information that was emotionally upsetting, what happens is they pick up in the first dream a very negative view of their situation. And the dream will be kind of short and flat and dull, but negative. And they are passive and not doing much about the bad situation. But as the night goes on, from one REM period to the next, you see that process working through, and they are matching it to older memories, like, I not only lost my husband right now, but I lost a pet in the past that I loved. I lost a boyfriend in the past. And you associate that loss to other kinds of experience you have in your memory, long-term memory, and you match it, and that diffuses. Well, I got over that one, and I got over that one. And so you begin by the end of the night to say, okay, I guess I can face this with a more upbeat attitude when I wake up. Mm. So you do that process, and it is a healthy one, and it helps mood from before sleep being very negative to waking mood in the morning being much more positive.
Now,
that's what works.
Yeah. Now, if let's say if I'm a personality that tends to get stuck, when I go to bed at night, can I prepare myself for what my mind is going to work through?
Can you pre-program?
Yeah.
The plot?
Yeah.
Everybody has tried that. You know... Some people try it. Well, I've tried it every which way also, because it would be wonderful if we could select our problem and help it along, give it a push, saying, okay, let's go to work while I sleep. Isn't that wonderful?
Mm.
But it's very difficult to do. And I say it's like digestion. It works for you without you paying any attention to it. So you really should leave it alone unless it gets stuck. You know, if you have a tummy ache, you got to pay attention. And if your dreams are stuck, you have to pay attention. That is stuck in terms of either waking you during the night in a feeling of anxiety or dread, or fear that something is going to happen that is very disastrous. Mm. If that happens repeatedly, then that is a strong message that the dreaming is not working, and you really need to pay attention to how to help that. And in my book, I have not only many examples, but some helpful hints about how to get the dream process back working in terms of helping you get to sleep and stay asleep and let it do its work.
Very good. This is Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this morning, sleep researcher Rosalind Cartwright. She's the author of the new book, The 24-Hour Mind, The Role of Sleep and Dreaming in Our Emotional Lives. She is Professor Emeritus of Rush University Medical Center's Graduate College Neuroscience Division. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. The email address is will-talk, talk@illinois.edu. WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call. A listener waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to hear your voice in the morning, Celeste.
Thank you.
You're a real compliment. Actually, I have two. One is that, unfortunately, our society, because people are doing more and more, are getting less sleep. So the first question is, what's the impact, you know, in terms of the process, because they're getting less sleep, wouldn't be, you know, in terms of the deep sleep or the REM. The other one is that our tend toward multitasking, and now multitasking with lots of interruptions, you know.
Yep.
Texting, you know, back, forth, and back. So I'll just hang up and let you comment on these two, and marvelous program.
Thank you for the call this morning.
Okay, question one. What happens when we shorten sleep? You can get away with it for a night or two, but not on a regular basis. What we know is that we will get the deep sleep first, no matter what happens. That is, if you stay up too late and have to get up at the same time, you're going to get your deep sleep as the first sleep of the night, and so REM will be sacrificed at the end of the night. Same thing happens if you have to get up too early. You get to sleep at your usual time, but you have to get up at 5 because you have something to prepare for tomorrow that you hadn't finished last night. Whatever you do about shortening sleep is going to impact the dreaming sleep more heavily than the deep sleep. So what happens if you lose a good deal of REM sleep? What we know is that the next time you get a decent night, you will have a big rebound of REM. You will get much more REM sleep than is an average proportion. And so, you know, you can sacrifice sleep for a few nights in a row, and then you'll get a REM bash. Now, that's okay if you do it on occasion, but if you are foreshortening sleep as a regular basis, you'll find that you will be a little more anxious in the morning, snappish, not in a good mood, likely to be irritable. So that happens first in terms of emotion. You're not as focused on problem solving, learning of routine things or performing routine things is fine. You can do that, but new things, it's going to take you longer to absorb them. And also in terms of health, we know that you will tend to eat sweets, have your coffee and donuts and maybe an extra donut if you're short of sleep, and you begin to put on weight. Short sleepers tend to become obese wakers. And that, we know, is a big problem in this country. And sleep is one reason. Short sleep is one reason for the high obesity. And, of course, we know that short sleep also then impacts hormonal balance in terms of we become much more vulnerable to diabetes, and we get the increase of that sugar level that overwhelms the system. And diabetes is the long-term effect of short sleep. And we know that that is rising in our country as well. So altogether, it's a bad idea to shorten sleep and give preference to wake time when your wake time would be much more productive if you get your full night's sleep. The other question, what about multitasking? And I'm not quite sure what you mean about the interruption that occurs when you're not able to complete one task because you're trying to do too many others. How sleep and dreaming fits into that. I know that if you interrupt sleep with, waking for a period to work on a problem that you had not finished the night before and then go back to sleep, sometimes that's helpful. That sets you on a path to continue thinking about that for the rest of the night, and often you'll wake up being able to solve a problem much more quickly. But if you do it routinely and for long periods of waking at night, that is not productive. So in all things, moderation is the best answer.
And I've got another call we're going to take in just a second, but I do want to make a follow-up question here in regard to our first caller. How much sleep do you think we need?
That is such an individual profile variable, just like height and weight and everything else. There's a range, and some people are very good short sleepers. Some require much longer sleep than the usual 7.9 hours, which is our mean. So what we know is that less than 6.5 begins to have an impact on health, mental health, and physical health. So 6.5 is sort of our borderline criterion cutoff. And anybody who takes more than 9 or 10 hours, again, is in some risk of trouble. Oversleeping is as bad as undersleeping. So we need to stay somewhere in the middle to be healthy. But it's up to you to find out what your most comfortable balance is by letting vacation time tell you when you're not required to get up at any particular hour. Let the body set its own rhythm, and you'll find, I feel much better after 8, and I've been giving myself only 6 or 7, then let your body teach you that 8 is your best target for the night.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line 2. Hello?
Hi. I've had pretty bad PTSD since I was, 15 was probably when I was first diagnosed. And while most of the other problems have been pretty well taken care of, it's been about 10 years since I've been able to sleep without the aid of medication. And I've done a sleep study. I do all the things that I'm told are, good
helpful.
To fix those problems, like exercise and eating well and all of those things. But I just seem really sensitive to changes in the seasons, and overall, without certain medications, I can't get more than 3 hours of sleep. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts.
I have lots of thoughts. The PTSD symptoms have mostly disappeared for you, except poor quality of sleep.
I have trouble getting to sleep, and I have trouble staying asleep.
Staying asleep, both.
Yeah.
Okay. But in sleep, you're not having nightmares that wake you anymore. Is that right?
Yeah, it's been a few years.
Good. Okay, so let's talk about getting to sleep and staying asleep without touching on the dreaming. Getting to sleep really requires that you tune down, both physiologically relax and psychologically turn off the negative thinking and get relaxed mentally as well. I recommend something really simple. And if you've got a bathtub, it'll work. If you've got a shower, it's not as good. Have you got a bathtub to work with?
I do.
Wonderful. Then 2 hours before your bedtime, take a long, hot soak. and I really mean as hot as you can stand, up to your neck, because you really want to get your core body temperature too high, about 2 degrees up from your normal temperature. And I say 2 hours before bedtime, because after about a 20-minute soak, you'll get out pink and limp as a noodle. You'll be physiologically very relaxed, but okay, your temperature will be too high. Now, your core, your thermostat, internal thermostat, will start adjusting that temperature down. So for the next hour and a half before your bedtime, after you get out of your soak, your core temperature will start dropping. When we go to sleep on a dropping temperature, we sleep longer and deeper. That I know, that's good research, and I can quote the studies if you like, and I've done it a lot for insomniacs. So getting to sleep is really helped by getting that temperature too high and letting it drop for the next hour and a half. You'll get drowsy naturally.
Okay.
But what are you going to do for that hour and a half psychologically so you turn off mentally as well? Don't worry. Do all your worrying before your tub. Write it down. Close the book. Get into the tub and relax. And then when you get out, you do something absolutely fun. I mean, you watch an old Groucho Marx comedy or, you know, something that is not a murder mystery, not a problem of your own to work on. That's all done before you get in the tub. So you have an hour and a half to just deep breathe, if somebody has taught you how to do deep breathing.
Yeah.
And read something light and frivolous, or watch an old movie that is a comedy for an hour and a half, then go to bed, and you'll be surprised. You'll be drowsy. It'll be hard to stay awake for the hour and a half. You'll be drowsy, and you will fall asleep quickly. Now, should you wake up after, you know, 3 hours is what you said is your typical longest stretch at a time. If you wake up, what you have to do is say to yourself, you look at the clock and you say, oh my gosh, it's only 3 in the morning. What am I doing awake? You say instead, oh, it's 3 o'clock. Wonderful. I have 5 more hours to sleep. You know, you take a positive attitude of, isn't that peachy? I've got so much more sleep time ahead of me. And do again your deep breathing at that time. Relax the body, relax the mind, and drift off.
Okay.
Okay. Give it a shot.
Thank you.
Okay. Sweet dreams. And next we take a call from a listener on line 1 in Champaign. Hi.
Yes, good morning. What about us older folks who get up every 3 hours to go to the bathroom?
Don't turn on the light is the first message, because a bright light suppresses the melatonin, which is released as we fall asleep. So you don't want to suppress melatonin with bright light. If you need a little night light to find the bathroom safely without stumbling and falling, which is even worse, then, you know, you can use a low light, like a night light, but no bright lights, so that you can get back to sleep quickly.
And without intruding on the privacy of the previous caller, what is PTSD?
Post-traumatic stress disorder. And it is really rampant in our veterans, unfortunately. They're coming home with about 40% showing this disorder. And it means that they are very vulnerable to a loud noise during the day. They're hypervigilant. They're, you know, fearful. They're having a really bad time adjusting. and they're nightmaring at night. And so, you know, we're working out lots of treatments for these people. And you can get PTSD following not just wartime horrors, but a bad accident, a rape, you know, somebody attacking you. Any other trauma might leave you with post-traumatic stress disorder. But now there is help for that.
Another reason to avoid war.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Not at all.
Thank you for the call this morning. We have an email question for us this morning. Would someone who always wakes up in the middle of their sleep have problems? And that's the headline of the email. And the individual says they fall asleep in front of the TV for about 5 hours, are awakened, and then finish their sleep with at least another 3 hours, this time in bed.
Uh-huh. So the problem is get into the bed before you fall asleep over TV. You know, you can, that's hard to do. If you're watching something you're really interested in, you know, they say in the How to Sleep Better books, don't have a TV in your bedroom. The heck with that. I say yes. Put your TV in your bedroom so that you can fall asleep in your own bed when you're watching. That's one part of the answer to that one. And then, you know, I'm really curious about 5 hours on in the living room before you get into bed. That's a long sleep. And I'm wondering whether this person is overtired, that is, so fatigued that they just can't manage to get enough sleep and are overwhelmed with sleepiness when they come home from work. And, you know, those people can fall asleep over the 6 o'clock news and do most of their sleeping in that first period. If that's the case, then they have to look at what they're doing during the day to get that fatigued, and take a look at whether you're working too hard or too many jobs or too long a stretch that is over-fatiguing you.
And also, this listener wants to know, why is oversleeping, why is too much sleep bad for us?
Well, let's just say that we know the mortality rates are much higher for oversleepers than for moderate sleepers. Now, why it is not as clear as in some other cases, but one of the problems certainly is sleep apnea. If you're not breathing well at night, if you're having pauses in breathing, you will oversleep, but it isn't the oversleeping that's so bad for you. It is the breathing disorder that needs attention. Now, the cardinal symptoms of having sleep apnea is that you snore like a trooper. So anybody who's in the same bed or the same house with you might be able to tell you whether your breathing is obstructed enough to make a lot of noise at night. If that's the case, then you're likely to need attention to the sleep apnea. And that is a cause of heart attacks and stroke. So that may be the reason why the mortality rate is higher for the oversleepers.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Chicago on line 4. Good morning.
Certainly can be helpful in problem solving. I know there were several examples throughout history where some scientists uncovered a solution to some problems they were contemplating. I'm thinking of the Nobel Prize winning scientist Szilard, who remembered the combination that led to his formulation of a particular chemical reaction, and then some other scientists in various other fields came up with this. I think also the one who invented the sewing machine needle and a couple
That's
other
right.
things came to mind. But then in terms of sleeping and getting to sleep, breathing, and meditation is also a helpful factor in getting the body to relax and breathe.
Absolutely.
Yes, thank you. And a few other things, but in response to the last person talking about leaving the TV on, the input from whatever sound is emanating from the TV or radio or whatever a person is exposed to, I wonder how that's influencing their emotional reaction and responses to a certain degree, you know, like if they were waking, they might respond with humor and laughter, but if something's tragic or despairing or horrible, how that would impact our dream status while we're sleeping and so forth. But you've got a wonderful program. I'm certainly going to look into your book. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. Now, you had a lot packed into that one question. Let me see if I can untangle and answer some of it. Whether sleep can be that creative, and dreaming give you an answer to a major scientific breakthrough. Yes, there's an awful lot of anecdotal evidence only. Nobody has done this as an experiment that I know of. However, it's not just science. It's creative products. I think it was Carly Simon who said she wakes up with a song fully ready to be written down, both words and music, from dreaming. And many other creative people have said, you know, the writer of the Kubla Khan, that story also came out of dreaming. But so it could be poetry or music as well as scientific breakthroughs. There is, I'm sorry, I've just remembered, there is one study, a mathematical puzzle was given to a number of volunteers before sleep to work on. They couldn't solve it and went to sleep, and more of them solved it when they woke up quickly and easily than those who stayed awake. So they did have a control group that stayed awake for the same length of time and could not solve it, but the sleepers got the cue to how to solve that mathematical puzzle, and it was published. I think it had a catchy title like Solve Your Problems in Your Sleep or something, but it was done by a rigorous method and published in a scientific journal. So there is one study for sure that was done with good methodology that shows, yes, sleep is helpful and dreaming is what triggers it at the end of the night to resolve various kinds of creative and interesting problems.
And the other interesting question that he posed was, if you fall asleep and you've got the radio on or the television
yeah.
on, you know, the content can creep into your unconscious.
That's true. You know, when I said, sure, put the TV in your bedroom, if you're falling asleep to that and you can't wake up enough to get into your bed, it would be better to start in your bed. But I really thought that at the end of the program that they would be able to turn off the TV. But if they're sleeping right through it, yes, that's not such a good idea, because not only might it influence the content of the night, but it would cause you to sleep more lightly. You would not have as good deep sleep, which is typically more... less imaging, less dreaming, and more just random thoughts. And that is when you get the good health benefits of sleep. So you don't want to be more light in your sleep at the beginning of the night.
which would rob you of that nice deep sleep.
Okay. Let's take another telephone call, a listener in Urbana on line three. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I have two questions. The first personal, the second something from the 70s. I never sleep more than about 5 hours. Over the last 50 years or so, I wake up after about 5 hours sleep and usually can't
get
back to sleep.
Cannot get back to sleep?
No. I'll just lie there. I go to sleep immediately, so almost as soon as I'm in the bed.
Uh-huh.
And I'll sleep soundly.
How do you feel when you wake up after five?
Okay.
No problems? Not grumpy?
Well, I'm always grumpy. No, I don't think so. Often during the summer, I just go out to the garden and start working in the garden.
Do you nap at all during the day?
Sometimes I do for half an hour or so.
Uh-huh.
If I begin to feel tired, I will.
Uh-huh. You know, I don't say, it sounds like you're not having to get up and go to work promptly every morning. Is that true?
No longer. When I was working and when I was in school, I had the same issue. I usually go to bed about 11 o'clock, but if I go to bed earlier, I just wake up earlier.
Uh-huh. So 5 hours is about your normal rhythm of sleep. Is that what you're saying?
It seems to be, but could that be a problem? Apparently, for a long time, I had undiscovered sleep apnea, which is now treated.
Uh-huh. How is it treated?
With
CPAP?
Yes, that's right, with the pressurized air.
Uh-huh. And you're well adapted to that? You sleep?
I usually use a half-hour delay, and I'm asleep by then. And then it kicks in. Yeah.
Okay, but you do wake after about 5 hours total, just as you did before.
Yes.
Okay. Then, and you're getting up at that point, taking off the mask?
Yes, and then I'll come back to bed at times and put the mask back on, and usually I just can't go to sleep.
Well, you know, often we get nervous about sleeping, you know, when we say, oh, you know, doggone it, here I am awake and I should get more sleep. And then you're terribly alert. Am I sleeping? You know, you kind of wake up to find out if you're sleeping or not. Because at that point, your sleep is lighter. The end of the night is light sleep. And you know your core body temperature begins to get up for waking you up at about 5 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you will find that there is a natural rhythm to wake you, to get alert physiologically. And, you know, if I were you, at that point, I usually keep a bedside book, something that I'm interested in reading. And I pick up the book. I would pick up the book and read for a bit. And that usually makes me drowsy enough to get back to sleep. That may or may not help you, but I have used that tip myself and told many too early in the morning waker to do that. And one elderly man who had retired to Florida told me it was the best thing he'd ever learned, because he now has so much more knowledge to share with his grandchildren from having read at 5 o'clock in the morning all kinds of things when his core body temperature was again high and he was alert, and so he could read for a while. He did not get back to sleep. He stayed awake. For me, it's a very short period. You know, I can't keep my eyes open. After 10 minutes of reading, I'm back to sleep. But that's something you might try. I'm worried about you're not getting enough sleep total, because the end of the night is when sleep apnea incidents are much longer and more severe.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you take your mask off after 5 hours, you'd be in more trouble if you're lying awake. You know,
I always put it back on.
You always
just
do.
Just on general principles.
Okay,
yeah.
Good for you. Well,
and the reading trick will work. On the rare occasion when I have had difficulty going to sleep, I have some literary criticism and the anatomy of melancholy, and I guarantee either of those will put anyone to sleep.
Good for you.
And can I jump in here, listener, because I've
sure.
got a number of folks who are waiting. And...
Well, I have one question
okay.
I really would like to ask.
All right.
In the 70s, there were reports of Southeast Asians having frightening dreams, which sometimes led to heart failure. And was this apocryphal or a myth, or was there something to this? Usually males.
Yes, that was the Hmong.
Yes, particularly
yes.
the Hmong.
Right. I think it was not apocryphal. You know, there have been incidents of that kind reported in other cultures. And the Hmong, once they emigrated here, did not have that problem. And we think it was an altitude problem. They were living in very high altitude.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's go on and let other people ask questions.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Next, we take a call from a listener on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hi, very interesting show. I have three questions. The first, I myself have widely varied sleep requirements and tendencies over the course of a year, ranging at its most intense from a period where I'll only be able to sleep 3-4 hours, wake up totally refreshed, lots of creative problem solving happening, to
energy and mood.
Different period where I have to sleep 10 hours and don't have much energy. Are there methods to modulate?
Is the long sleep tending to start in fall and go through winter? Are you hibernating?
I used to think so, but those highs and lows have not always historically corresponded directly to the seasons in that way.
They have not.
No.
Well, that's an interesting variation. And, you know, I think you're a circadian rhythm problem rather than a straight sleep problem. Have you taken a look at the circadian rhythm literature at all online?
No, I have not.
Oh, well, that's where I would go for an answer, because that's really a separate area of scientific inquiry, and they've done a lot of work on you are having a rhythm of sleep and waking, which is unusual, and I would suggest you direct that question. Can I give you a name?
Okay.
Somebody who you might bug to get an answer is at Rush, running a circadian rhythm lab, and that is Dr. Charmaine Eastman, E-A-S-T-M-A-N. Don't tell her I told you. She is running that lab and may be very helpful. I hope so.
Okay.
If I could ask another separate question.
Yeah.
The points were brought up about falling asleep with the TV continuing to pound input into your head, and also the ability to use sleep. Is there research that you could intentionally, say you wanted to learn a language or something, fall asleep with that audio input still coming at you?
That study is being done right now by somebody at Northwestern up in Chicago, and his name is, oh boy, let me see if I've got it on the tip of my tongue. I have to have a short distraction period, and then it'll pop into my mind.
Why don't I reintroduce us, And we're growing short on time, excuse me. But I'll reintroduce us, and then maybe we can get in one more call.
Okay.
This is Focus, and our guest this morning is sleep expert Rosalind Cartwright. She is the author most recently of The 24-Hour Mind, The Role of Sleep and Dreaming in Our Emotional Lives. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, this is Focus. We're happy to have you along with us this morning. Anything else there, Dr. Cartwright?
Well, I didn't come up with his name.
Well, another day.
Yeah. He's doing that study right now.
Okay, and that's at Northwestern.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
So maybe the listener could Google.
Well, he can Google, this person is in the psychology department. He's a cognitive psychologist, and he is now studying what kind of auditory stimuli can get through in sleep.
And we're going to have to wrap it up here. I can't believe how quickly this hour has flown by. Before we go, just a quick thought on sleep aids.
Yes. Stay away from medications. We've had too many problems with Ambien. The newspapers have been full of them. Ambien tends to precipitate sleepwalkers, even in people who have never had a sleepwalking episode in their lives. It now carries a warning sign. FDA has required that Ambien and Lunesta both carry a warning sign of possible sleepwalking episodes. Other kinds of aids over-the-counter are mostly antihistamine-based. Antihistamines tend to make you a little drowsy. They're safe. You don't get addicted to them. But really, good sleep hygiene is the best way to go for a sleep aid, is to clear your mind of worries beforehand and to relax the body.
Mm. There we have to leave it. Rosalind Cartwright, thank you very much for talking with us this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Rosalind Cartwright, author of The 24-Hour Mind. The book is published by the Oxford University Press.